Okay, great. So I'm going to be talking about accreting neutron stars. And so to start off with, I just wanted to remind you a little bit about accreting neutron stars. I'm going to be talking about those accreting in low-mass X-ray binaries. And so I just wanted to briefly run through what a low-mass X-ray binary is for those of you who haven't seen it before. So this is the best I could do at sketching a low-mass X-ray binary. Here's the point. So you have a neutron star, a green neutron star here, which is accreting from a low-mass companion. So the companion is typically of a solar mass or less, and material from the companion is spilling over the Roche lobe of the binary and accreting onto the neutron star via an accretion disk. The rate at which it's accreting is typically between 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 8 solar masses a year, and that gives you an accretion luminosity between 10 to the 36 and 10 to the 38 ergs per second, which typically comes out in the X-rays because the neutron star is only 10 kilometers across. If you were just want to get this luminosity out, it has to come out in X-rays. And the orbital period is between hours and days for these systems, typically. And the interesting thing about these neutron stars is that they're weakly magnetized, so the magnetic field is typically less than 10 to the 9 Gauss, so they're weakly magnetized. And in addition, we expect them to be rapidly rotating. And the reason we expect them to be rapidly rotating is because they're not only accreting mass, they're also accreting angular momentum. And so you can write down the rate of change of angular momentum of the neutron star is just the mass accretion rate times the specific angular momentum of the material coming off the inner edge of the disk. So if you just and if you integrate this equation over time, you can show that you can reach breakup frequency for the neutron star by accreting only about a tenth of a solar mass, which you can do easily in the lifetime of these systems. And so we expect them to be rapidly rotating. And these two things, rapid rotation and weak magnetic field, makes them astrophysically interesting because they're the favorite progenitors for making the millisecond radio pulsars. Okay, now in this talk, what I want to do is show you that the spins of these systems have been measured. So we know the spins of the neutron star for about 10 of these systems now, and I want to explain how those spins have been measured. So first of all, I'm going to talk about this one object, SACS-1808, which shows persistent pulsation. So in the X-ray light curve, it has a persistent pulsation, which is directly showing us the spin of the neutron star. And then I'm going to talk about type 1 X-ray bursts, which provide an additional way to measure the spins of these objects. And really, the point I want to make is that we can now measure and monitor the spins of these systems, of 10 of these systems, with X-rays. And so that could be promising for looking for gravity waves because you know the frequency to look for, and you can actually track it, at least in one system. Okay, so I'm going to start off with just the one system that shows pulsations in its persistent emission. So this system is SACS-1808, SACS-J1808. And if you look at the X-ray output from this system, what you see in the X-ray output is a very clear sinusoidal modulation at 401 hertz. And here's the folded light curve. So this is just the X-ray light curve. This is X-ray counts and against pulse phase. So they folded the pulse. And so you see pulsations of amplitude 5 to 10%, but at this frequency, 401 hertz. And the interpretation is what you're seeing is the neutron star has a weak magnetic field, something like 10 to the 9 Gauss. So when the accretion disk comes in, you disrupt the accretion flow in the very, very inner parts of the disk. And the disruption of the accretion flow by the magnetic field causes some kind of asymmetry on the surface. For example, you channel the accretion flow onto the magnetic polar caps. And then as the neutron star rotates, you actually get a modulation in the X-ray light curve. And just to show you how well we can actually follow the spin, you can actually extract the orbit of the binary. So I can't really resist showing this data. It's kind of some amazing data. So what they've done here is look at the pulse arrival time. So you know this 400 hertz signal. You look for the pulse arrival time and plot that, and you can see the Doppler shifts because of the binary orbit. And so you can get a very, very nice measurement of the binary orbit here. And again, perhaps this is a good candidate for gravity wave detection. You can follow the phase and the frequency of the period of the neutron star with X-ray observations, and you know where it is on the sky. Bilston estimated the gravity wave strength you might get, and he estimated about 10 to the minus 27, so it's quite small, but at least it's one neutron star where we know the spin. Okay, so now I want to move on to another technique which has enabled us to measure the spins of another 9 neutron stars in these low-mass X-ray binaries, and that's using type 1 X-ray bursts. So I just want to quickly tell you what type 1 X-ray bursts are. So the neutron star in these systems is accreting a mixture of hydrogen and helium. And so what happens is that you build up on the surface of the neutron star, you build up a pile of hydrogen and helium, a thin layer of hydrogen and helium on the surface, which eventually ignites and undergoes thermonuclear burning. What happens is that the temperature at the base of that layer eventually gets hot enough that the helium can ignite. And so you ignite the helium that you've accreted, and you very rapidly burn all the hydrogen and helium that you've accreted. And what you see is an X-ray burst, a burst of X-rays. And so I've just sketched that here. So I'm plotting X-ray luminosity against time. And what you see is that the persistent X-ray output here. And so you'll see this for several hours. Then all of a sudden, you'll see a brightening by a factor of 10 or 100, which decays in about 10 seconds. So you see this 10-second burst of X-rays every several hours, essentially. And what's happening is you're burning the fuel, the hydrogen helium that you put on the surface of the neutron star. OK, now the crucial point is that you don't expect to burn everything simultaneously over the whole surface of the neutron star. What's probably going to happen is that you're going to ignite at a local spot. And the reason is you're burning in seconds, but you accumulate for hours. So to get simultaneous ignition, you need to have very, very good synchronicity of the whole thermal state over the whole surface. But that's probably not going to happen. What's probably going to happen is that you ignite at a local spot. And if you ignite at a local spot, then you're just going to get some hot spot, basically, on the surface, some kind of burning inhomogeneity over the whole, on the surface, some kind of hotspot. And then if the neutron star is rotating, that hotspot's rotated in and out of the line of sight. And you expect to see a modulation of the X-rays at the rotation period. So this was predicted around about 1980. But it wasn't until the launch of the Rossi X-ray Timing Explorer satellite 5 years ago that people actually saw these oscillations. So this is the discovery observation. So what I'm plotting here is a real X-ray light curve of an X-ray burst. And you see here's the accretion luminosity here. And then suddenly it increased by a factor of 10 or more, and then decays in about 10 seconds. And this is this thermonuclear event. And if you just take the power spectrum of this light curve, what you see is, here's the power spectrum. You see a feature here at 363 hertz. And the interpretation is that what we're seeing is actually this hotspot. What we're seeing is some kind of hotspot which is being rotated modulated by the rotation, which is at a frequency of 363 hertz. Now, this kind of thing has been seen now in 9 systems, possibly 10 systems. And so what I've done is made a table of the observations so far. So I've listed the sources here in this column, and here are the spin frequencies. So there are nine systems here, and the spin frequencies range from around about 600 hertz all the way down to 270. So they're all within the factor of 2 of each other. They're between 300 and 600 hertz, the spin frequencies that have been measured. There is a marginal detection reported, a 2 sigma detection of a burst oscillation in this object SACS-1808, the persistent pulsator also. And here's I just made this rough handmade histogram of the spins. And so you can see that they're pretty tightly clustered between 250 and 600 hertz.
What is the gap?
Well, there is an issue here. Some people would like to claim that what you're seeing here is twice the spin. So that this bimodality you see is actually real, and that what we're seeing here is twice the spin. And maybe I'll mention that at the end. But that's an open issue right now. It's not clear whether the spins extend all the way across here or whether this bimodality is really true. What could be happening here is that you have 2 hotspots on the neutron star. Some people believe that. OK, so I just want to mention why are we convinced that these oscillations are rotation? OK. Well, really 3 reasons, I'd say. One is that these pulsations are extremely large amplitude. They're of order 100% during the burst rise. So if you look during the rise of that X-ray burst, they can be 80% amplitude pulsations, very, very large pulsations. So it's hard to see how you could do that by any other method. The frequency does actually change a little bit during the burst. The frequency changes a little bit. But you can model that. It only changes by a couple of hertz out of the 300. You can model that. And if you do that, you can get back a very coherent signal. So the signal, the inherent signal is very coherent. You can get Q values of about 4,000. So in other words, you can follow that pulse all the way through the burst, essentially. And it's a very stable frequency. So you can look at a particular source this year and compare the frequency with last year, and it'll be the same to 1 part in 10 to the 4. OK, but I don't want to give you the impression that the problem's solved. So I just want to end with talking about the puzzles with these observations. So I'd say that we're convinced that what we're seeing is the neutron star spin. But I just mentioned that the frequency does actually change by 1 or 2 hertz during the burst. And so you'd like to understand that. That's definitely a puzzle right now. There was a suggestion by Todd Strohmayer that perhaps it's angular momentum conservation. During the burst, the atmosphere expands. It gets hot. It expands out. And if it expands out, it'll spin down due to angular momentum conservation. So that's something that we've been looking at with Sharon Morsink and Daniel Holtz and Lars Bilson. We've been looking and John Freeman recently. And it looks like perhaps the drifts are too large to be explained by this explanation. That's something that's an open issue right now. We don't understand why are oscillations seen in the tail of the bursts, because the picture is the hotspot then has engulfed the whole star. Why do we see oscillations at all? You only see oscillations in some bursts from some sources. We don't know why. And then there's this issue about the bimodality. Perhaps it's bimodal, and that's an open issue. But what the point I'd like to emphasize is it does seem as if we're measuring the spins. And these are sort of further complications, if you like, on top of that. And if we can understand these complications, then we can start to probe the physics of the neutron star atmosphere. So we can ask about the magnetic fields. We can ask how does the nuclear burning spread. We can ask about angular momentum transport. So these observations are very important from that point of view. But I think the three things, the coherence, the large amplitude, and the stability of the frequency, are very convincing that we've actually measured the spin. OK, thanks.
So, a couple minutes of questions.
So you say that the frequency of these things is stable, is the same to 1 part in 10 to the 4 from 1 year to another. But on the other hand, the frequency is not determined any better than a part in 10 to the 2, basically. So what does the statement of 10 to the minus 4 mean?
Well, what you seem to see is that the frequency always starts a little bit low, but in the tail of the burst, it seems to, in many examples, it sort of asymptotically approaches some value in the tail. And so the interpretation is that what we're seeing in the tail is actually a neutron star spin, and it's that frequency that is repeatable from year to year. So, for example, in this angular momentum picture, early in the burst, what you're seeing is the frequency of some shell that's expanded. But then during the tail, once that's collapsed back to its original thickness, then the picture is you're seeing the spin. And it's that frequency in the tail that's constant.
If that were the case, then can you go from one burst to another and it's always the same to a part 10 to the 4? You require superposing many, many bursts in order to build up the frequency.
No, this is it's a very detectable signal. So this is actually so during a burst, you can chop it up into say half second intervals and very clearly detect the signals. So in the tail, you can make that measurement for an individual burst.
Assuming this is rotation, it's going to be spun up by the equation. How long do you have to wait to see that?
You have to wait quite a long time. So it's. It's not possible to see that so far. It's a small effect. I think you have to wait for probably of order 100 years is my guess, something like that. I think that's right.
I mean, we've been doing this now for 20 years, so it's not totally
safe. Well, we've only had these measurements for about 5, but I think but we'd have to wait. Yeah, it's I think about 100 years is right. Oh, that's just it's an X-ray binary which comes from the galactic center field of view, a burst which comes from the galactic center field of view. But because it's so confused, it's not clear exactly which object it is. So within that field of view, which one actually had the burst? But it's believed it's one particular object, but there's some uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so it's quite interesting. During the rise of those bursts, if you take spectra during the rise, you can see that the emitting area is increasing. So it does seem as if you start off with a small hotspot, which then gradually gets bigger and bigger and bigger and engulfs the whole surface. So at the maximum, the area is consistent with being the whole surface. And also, interestingly, during the rise, there are bursts where you see the amplitude decrease. So as the hotspot gets bigger and bigger, the modulation amplitude drops, so that's a consistent picture. But then the puzzle is, in the tail of the burst, if that's really what's going on in the tail of the burst, if the burning front spread over the whole surface, then why do you see anything? And that's a puzzle.